Hi, Mark.
Hello, Brink. How are you?
I'm good. Just to introduce ourselves, I'm Brink Lindsay from the Cato Institute.
Mark Kleinman, UCLA, and the reality-based community.
Very nice to chat with you today. We've actually had a couple of occasions to meet in the flesh.
Yes.
Both of them, I believe, were in the context of libertarian events that I had cooked up. First, we met out at in your backyard at UCLA at a liberal-libertarian political theory conference, and then we got you to come out to D.C. To speak at one of these monthly libertarian dinners that I hold together with my friend Steve Tellis, and you gave a great talk about your upcoming book.
Thank you. Yeah, Steve's an old friend, and that was a great dinner. That was a very good audience.
So it's nice now to get together in this forum and talk about the strange state of the world.
Right. So here's a question I've been meaning to ask my libertarian friends.
Yes.
Why is it that every time liberals adopt the libertarian idea, the libertarians run away from it? So cap and trade, right, was the great libertarian conservative alternative to technical environmental regulation. Let's not tell people how much they put out of their smokestacks. Let's just give them a price or do the equivalent in terms of ration coupons. So, and for years, libertarians made fun of liberals and environmentalists for not seeing the obvious economic logic of cap and trade or Pigouvian taxes.
Right.
And slowly, that resistance got worn down, and now market simulating mechanisms are accepted environmental dogma. And suddenly, global warming is a communist plot, and cap and trade is going to destroy the economy.
Well, I think you've done a little sleight of hand here. That is that when we all agree that a particular emission is problematic and needs abating, then the economist solution that a tax or tradable emission permits is better than command and control regulation. I think that is a victory for economists that and particularly libertarian oriented economists that idea has become kind of trans-ideological conventional wisdom. The debate we're having now is over whether the particular emission is one that deserves being abated in this way. So we've got the question of climate change, and I think everybody who's in the mainstream agrees that it's been happening and agrees that all the evidence suggests that humans have played a role in it and that carbon dioxide emissions have played a role in it. The big question is the costs and benefits of doing something about it through abating carbon emissions. And so I don't think the primary issue here is the means of abatement. The question is whether abatement's the right idea.
Right. But presumably, if we agree that there's a problem, and we agree that people respond to market incentives, then current carbon emissions must be supra-optimal because people are using up this scarce resource and not paying for it.
Right.
So that seems to me, again, elementary economics. There ought to be some charge for adding to the greenhouse gas burden, not just carbon dioxide, but other things. So the question of how stiff the charge is and how slowly it should be phased in is a different question. My own view is that we ought to pass a tax or a cap and trade now to take effect 3 years from now and to ramp up the tax slowly or the ramp down the number of ration coupons slowly over the next 20 years so there's never a shock to the economy. But what I haven't noticed is any enthusiasm on the part of the people who said, well, you know, we're against environmental protection because these regulations are really stupid and Stalinist, to say, okay, now that we know how to do it and that the environmentalists have agreed that we ought to do it that way, these are the restrictions we're for. I mean, I haven't seen any arguments from libertarians saying, you know, particulates really a problem. We ought to hit it with a heavy tax. So You know, I have the feeling that if we ever completely voucherize the public school system, that wouldn't improve libertarian support for public education. They then start saying, well, why don't we cut the budget for that? I'm getting the feeling that liberals have been chasing a rainbow that's not there.
I hear your mistrust. Let me see what I can say about it. I think, again, you're stealing a bit of a march by assuming that carbon emissions are an externality that needs to be internalized. They're an externality that needs to be internalized if the harm they're causing is something that that can be internalized in a way where the internalization doesn't cost more than the harm. Otherwise, we're in a cure worse than disease situation. And since the externality doesn't seem to be hitting until sometime a century from now, when the planet's presumably much, much richer than it is today, and since the actual levels of carbon emission control that's supposedly needed to do anything about the change in temperature levels are pretty draconian, and we don't know how to do those kind of draconian limits without really, kneecapping economic growth. It looks to me like the prescription is serious hits to well-being in the world today for a gain to a much richer world down the road. Or if we just restrict our scheme to the United States, then we do something that is utterly trivial in terms of having any impact on temperatures for some gain a long, long time from now. So all that said, I'm not averse to the general idea of taxing bads rather than goods, and so if we could come up with some revenue-neutral scheme to tax carbon instead of labor and investment, I'm open to that idea. Let me also just challenge your question that we know how to do this. That is, we know how to do cap and trade. I don't think the legislation that just passed the House indicates we know how to do that. I think it indicates we know how to produce a squalid special interest festival that hands out freebies to all kinds of people and also sticks in all kinds of mandates that do more work than the cap and trade system, which doesn't seem to do much work for decades. So I question your grounds for pessimism on several fronts. That is because I don't yet see a good faith effort in this area by liberals to take libertarian insight seriously, and so you don't have to worry about our good faith just yet because I'm too busy worrying about yours.
Well, I don't see. I mean, there was no Republican, as far as I can tell, who was prepared to vote for a straight carbon tax or cap and trade equivalent. Right, all those horrible things that happened to that bill in the House happened because it was necessary to get all of the Democratic votes because there wasn't going to be a single Republican vote, no matter what the bill said.
I agree with you there. Of course, there are goodly number of free market Republican-leaning economists leading the charge, Greg Mankiw, who sign on to the idea of a Pigouvian carbon tax.
They brought zero Republican legislators with them.
I'm not here to defend the Republican Party.
I see.
A lot of the gimmies, though, were, of course, the Democratic Party legislators from energy-intensive, coal-intensive coal-using states. So I think it's a bipartisan issue that people who represent real-life voters don't want to be held responsible for jacking their energy costs up through the roof. And so there you go. Democracy in action, not very pretty.
But you say you don't want to defend the Republican Party, but is there no Republican legislator that you would count as a loyal libertarian?
I don't have stock in any politician these days at all. How about that?
Okay, all right, but then think about what you're saying to liberals. You're saying abandon your efforts to do the stuff you want, make an alliance with us, and we have zero votes to deliver for our ideas.
There's nobody
we can actually have vote your way because you did what we wanted.
No, my whole libertarian shtick doesn't have anything to do with a political alliance between constituencies, because I'm quite aware that self-conscious libertarian types are thin on the ground. So any idea premised on an alliance between currently self-identified libertarians and currently self-identified liberals, I think is just going nowhere. My idea is for a reconception of liberalism that takes seriously a bunch of libertarian insights, and as well as liberal insights, and that kind of liberalism that has liberated itself to a much greater extent than today from kind of knee-jerk statism and from the coalitional psychology of long-term association with organized labor would be capable of appealing to the big ideological center that calls itself economically conservative and socially liberal. But right now,
would be capable or not?
What's that?
You say would be capable or wouldn't be?
Would be. Or at least be in a position to. It would be in a position to actually propose public policies that makes sense for running a 21st century liberal capitalist democracy. I have this naive faith that eventually good ideas can find constituencies. But I'm not a political consultant. I don't know anything about how to get to 51% in the current toxic partisan environment.
Mm-hmm. So what is it that libertarians ought to compromise on in making this grand alliance?
In short, I think on the need for some level of a welfare state, for that that I think that the kind of hardline holdout idealism for a libertopia in which government is restricted to enforcing contracts and defending private property is a non-starter and not even a very good idea. I think that the public good of providing legal infrastructure for markets is something libertarians subscribe to. I think there are other public goods as well that conduce to producing a viable, thriving free society, and among those are some kinds of redistribution things that that take account of the fact that you can't choose your parents, and so by the time we start, libertarians expect people to be responsible for their own actions, to exert autonomy over their own lives, and yet the fact is that the circumstances in which you're raised and the community you grew up with have enormous impact on your capacity to assume personal responsibility and exercise autonomy. And of course you don't get to choose those circumstances. So I think some kinds of remedial policies that help folks from disadvantaged circumstances, I think a policy of support for education to raise everyone's capacities to exercise their freedom more fully, I think those are all good ideas. I think to maintain public support for the creative destruction of free markets, we need some kind of safety net to protect people from the vagaries of bumptious market competition. Mm-hmm. So on those fronts, I think a combination of free markets and social liberalism and a real but limited welfare state is, to me, the right mix of policies. I see that mix of policies split in half, at least rhetorical support for free markets going with folks who are completely wedded these days to the most illiberal kinds of social attitudes. And also to a a kind of knee-jerk hostility to the need for redistribution, or a real just sort of general lack of concern for folks who need help. And on the other side, social liberalism and egalitarianism are mixed in with a lot of knee-jerk suspicion of free market policies and kind of path-dependent allegiance to early to mid 20th century social democracy institutions that don't work very well.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to scramble the deck just intellectually, and then maybe we can talk about Republican and Democratic Party politicians in real life.
Right. So, all right, so on the principle that if you're given an inch, you should try to take an L, you talk about redistribution, and there I think we agree, not maybe as to scale, but as to the principles.
Yep.
And you talk about the general principle of public goods, and as a card-carrying liberal, of course, I'm prepared to carry that pretty far. Seems to me there are lots of things that are naturally not sold at their marginal cost. Information being the most obvious example, ask any newspaper publisher.
Yes.
And so I'm very sympathetic to Mike O'Hare's idea that instead of trying to enforce copyrights on recorded music, we should put a tax on something or other, it might be bandwidth, and pay the recording industry its roughly $12 billion a year in current revenues, and divide that those revenues up according to some principle of the stuff that gets listened to gets paid for, and basically have what looks like a market in producing music to be listened to, but where you don't collect from the listener. Because the efficient price, obviously, is zero. It doesn't cost anything to have somebody listen to a CD. Now, I can see six problems with doing that in practical terms. It seems to be the principle of having the government provide zero marginal cost goods is a pretty strong one. You mentioned contract enforcement. I'd put science on that same list. A pretty long list of things that simply can't be paid for by charging the can't efficiently be paid for
yeah.
by charging the users. So that's the second dimension. And then the third dimension is paternalism, right? I mean, so my own specialty has been drug policy.
Right.
I actually think there's a paradox around drug policy for libertarians because you'd like, as a libertarian, for there to be law enforcement, but as little law enforcement as possible, right? That's one other form
yes.
of intrusive state. So my question always is, imagine you were running a security at a football stadium, and you had to decide how many security guards to put in the stands.
Mm-hmm.
Would your answer change if I told you whether or not we were selling beer?
Probably would.
Probably would, and therefore, being libertarian with respect to intoxicants.
Yeah.
May lead to the need for more law enforcement of other kinds.
Yes.
Now, that's not to deny the fact that it's also the case that our drug regulations, as they're currently written and administered, are enormously criminogenic. But that's not a question of principle. The principle that anybody should be able to take any intoxicant he wants, whatever he wants, which lots of my libertarian friends, hold as a pretty close principle, and this
yep.
is not original, right? I mean, On Liberty was written about the Maine alcohol prohibition law.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that problem, that whole set of problems, has been underanalyzed from the libertarian side.
Well, you've said a lot. Let me try to unpack it a little bit. First, while I think the intellectual framework of externalities and internalizing external costs is a useful one in particular contexts. I think the sort of general idea of internalizing all externalities is hopeless, and in fact, that way lies madness. Almost all the good things we enjoy in life are the result of externalities. The free market is one gigantic externality-producing machine. We call it consumer surplus, or we can address the fact that entrepreneurs who come up with great new gizmos capture only the tiniest sliver of the wealth created from doing so. And so if indeed we internalized all of those externalities, you know, the huge benefits of this prosperity generating machine would never unfold.
Let me stop you there. I mean, it seems to me the argument that something produces positive externalities is an argument for subsidizing it. And in fact, we do subsidize entrepreneurship in various ways, not least by providing courts and contracts. But it's not clear to me, given your argument.
I agree that just as a general matter, if you're looking at something that seems like it's a social problem and you see that part of the problem is external costs or external benefits, then you can come up with a policy to address that problem. I think record industry profits are not a problem.
Record industry profits are not a problem. The collapse of the activity of producing recorded music is a problem. It's no longer possible to run a band that lives on its record revenues. If the band doesn't tour, it can't live.
And that's a social problem. How?
Presumably, if there are people who would like to listen to music,
but that's not silly, Mark.
As much music as they want to.
No, so I think absolutely. If just copyright vanished tomorrow, what would vanish? The big record companies and the big record company produced pop stars, people performing live, people selling records that on a small scale basis would thrive fine. And I'm not convinced that the quality of musical production or the quality of musical enjoyment would suffer at all if the current mode of kind of mass music production went the way of the dodo.
And was replaced with nothing.
Not replaced with nothing. Replaced with a different business model, one based on performance for the primary source of revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And so people give away their recordings to generate interest in their live gigs, or they just live off their live gigs.
Which can work with a rock band, works less well with a classical symphony orchestra.
Yeah.
And if you look at the production of classical music CDs, that's basically disappeared.
That is true, or so far as I know. This isn't an area that I've thought a great deal about. It is possible that some kind of scheme along the lines of that you talk about might make sense, but I'd rather just see things shake out for a while. What I think both of us might agree on is that the current copyright regime is one that just seems fundamentally out of step with the developments in technology and efforts to shore it up and enforce it are just leading to more and more kind of draconian and nasty, producers treating their customers as criminals, and that doesn't seem like a very healthy model.
And the patent system is comparably messed up in a different way.
What's that?
The patent system is comparably messed up, though in a different way.
Yes. So on the drug prohibition front, I'm very scary of I'm very leery of extending preventive regulation too far. If you're given the freedom to do X, you might do some bad thing, the freedom to do X leads to some really small fraction of people doing bad things, and therefore nobody should have the freedom to do X. I don't like that. I prefer letting people be free and then be responsible for their own actions. So as a general matter, I'm quite libertarian on ingestion of substances.
Let me try a concrete example. Phil Cook, quite wonderful book called Paying the Tab. Do you know Phil? He teaches it at Duke.
I'm sorry, Phil who?
Phil Cook.
No, I do not know him. I know the name,
but
I don't know him.
I would add Paying the Tab to your reading list.
Okay.
It's really a fascinating book to me because I'm interested in alcohol policy.
Yeah.
But I would also give it to a class as a model of how to do a serious piece of policy analysis. And he makes the argument about what all the costs are of alcohol use, both to drinkers and to drinkers' families, and then to other people. So you've got three class of costs. You've got pure external costs. You've got the intra-family cost that economists usually ignore. And then you've got what might be called the excess internal cost, the cost of imperfect self-command. So he adds that up, and he's a very data-oriented person. He computes that doubling the tax on alcohol, the current tax is about 10 cents a drink, which is about 10% of the retail price, where a drink is a shot or 6 ounces of wine or a can of beer. They all have about the same amount of alcohol.
Yep.
If you double that tax from 10 cents to 20 cents, the resulting 10% increase in the price of alcohol would, according to Cook, reduce the homicide rate by about 6%, and have comparable impacts on some other kinds of crime, and of course on automobile accidents and automobile fatalities.
And is it correct that the level of alcohol taxes or the rate of alcohol taxation has gone fairly precipitously down over the past generation?
Correct. The peak was reached during the Korean War. And most of the taxes have not substantially changed in nominal terms since then. Remember, the alcohol taxes aren't ad valorem; they're specific excises. It's so much per gallon.
So their bite has been inflated away.
Exactly. And the other point that Cook makes is that if you put an extra 10 cents a drink tax on somebody who had two drinks a day, would be paying in taxes about $6 a month. So that in order for that tax to really hit you in the wallet,
right,
you have to be drinking too much.
Yeah. So I'm not crazy about the justice of taxing the vast majority of drinkers who don't do anything bad because some of their number do. So you're not really internalizing costs. Because a lot of these people aren't imposing costs.
Right.
On the other hand, it's an imperfect world, and you got to tax something to raise revenue. And I'm sympathetic to the idea of as I said, taxing bads rather than taxing goods.
Right. On that, we are completely in agreement.
Right. The fact is, of course, that this steps on some of your progressive toes because these taxes tend to be pretty regressive.
That's an argument that's frequently heard. I think largely from advocates of the alcohol industry.
Okay.
Again, the extent of the revenues involved are such that it would be trivial by varying other taxes or by varying other expenditure programs to more than make up for the sheer regressivity. The serious problem here is what John Calkins and I have called specific impoverishment. So if you have somebody who's poor and a heavy drinker, then this tax hits that person hard. On the other hand, the reduction in alcohol is probably important. The really bothersome case is tobacco, where the increase in tobacco taxes really hit poor smokers very, very hard.
Gotcha.
And I think in an unjustifiable way, because again, people were thinking about revenue rather than social perfection.
Gotcha.
But I've been puzzled. I mean, there's a brief flurry of interest in taxes on sugar and high fructose corn syrup beverages to help pay for the health care bill. And that sort of faded. As far as I can tell, there's not been a whisper about alcohol taxation. The Cook proposal would lead to about $9 billion a year in extra revenues, which is a fair distance toward the required number. And it's just never gotten on the table.
That's interesting.
Beer distributors have enormous amounts of political power.
Yep. Well, let's. That's a
some,
maybe that's
some
a nice.
Have sons-in-law run for president.
Maybe that's a nice segue. We've been too sober-minded policy wonks here, talking about things that we could agree on if we ruled the world, and trying to come to some sensible compromises or common ground. But that doesn't have much to do with how public policy is actually made in the United States. And so let's talk about, instead of sober-minded policy wonks, let's talk about angry, crazy people, otherwise known as voters, and in particular the latest examples, the birthers and the angry attendees at town hall meetings.
Right. Now, as far as I can tell from the polling, those don't constitute a very heavy segment of voters, but they do constitute a substantial segment of angry people, and angry people do things. So I think there's been a lot of discussion that, you know, that we're seeing at these town hall meetings what the American population really thinks of the health care bill. And that strikes me as a somewhat crazy opinion. We're seeing what the Fox News audience thinks, because they're the people who are being urged to come out. I think it's unfair to say about the town hall attendees that they're a rent-a-mob like the group that shut down the Florida recount. I mean, those were Republican Hill staffers. These folks are, by and large, perfectly sincere citizens.
Yes.
Who have been told by Sarah Palin that Obama's going to kill their grandmother. And, you know, if I thought the president was going to kill my grandmother, I'd go out to a town hall meeting, and I wouldn't be very polite about it.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I think those people can be fairly criticized for being too immune to data. But it's really an interesting picture, and it's, I think, striking the extent to which it's being fed by people who have, or at least had, serious national political careers. So Sarah Palin, Newt Gingrich, and then of course the talkers like Dobbs and O'Reilly and Hannity, and Limbaugh, of course.
Yes,
I mean, there was, of course, a comparable fury on my side of the aisle against George W. Bush.
Yeah, so
I think it was substantially better based, but also the real lunatic part of it never had any support among serious electeds or serious liberal commentators. I mean, that was all sort of Democratic underground fringe stuff. So I don't think there was no Sarah Palin equivalent accusing George W. Bush of having plotted the 9/11 attacks. And that just didn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, Cynthia McKinney, she was an elected official, but she wasn't as high stature, I guess, as Sarah Palin. But, they existed.
And was quickly purged.
What's that?
And Cynthia McKinney was quickly purged, right? She lost the next primary.
That's right. So I just wanted to talk about this issue of kind of symmetrical crazy opinions. The birther idea has been one that's given me sort of grim amusement following what's going on. And there's a wonderful new article in Esquire that's online by John Richardson, where he follows around the head of the birthers, this woman, Orly Tights. I'm not sure if I pronounced her name right.
I think it's Tates. Yeah, I think she's being purged because she's too crazy even for that.
But the amazing thing is that the birth certificate issue just seems to be the tip of the iceberg. That is, that's the thing that gets all the press, but that's like the least crazy thing this cohort of people are talking about. So apparently Tates was in this, he's following her to this meeting where she's trying to get the FBI interested in investigating Obama's wrongdoing, and she's talking about a cemetery in Arizona where they've just dug 30,000 fresh graves, and Baxter International, a major Obama contributor, has developed a vaccine for bird flu that kills people. And there's a House Bill 684 where they're planning civilian labor camps and just all kinds of, really cuckoo stuff.
But you've been following this more closely than I have.
Yeah, well, we'll post a link to it because it's just a fun / terrifying article to read.
Astonishing.
But the issue of the Obama's place of birth, the polls seem to show something near a majority of Republicans, something near 50% of Republicans either don't believe he was born in this country or can't say for sure. And
right.
That's you know, that's kind of crazy. But then I was reminded to look up in the wonderful little book by Andrew Gelman, Red State, Blue State, Rich State, Poor State, and he's talking about polarized politics. And he refers to a 2007 Rasmussen poll in which 51% of Democrats either believed or didn't know whether Bush knew about the 9/11 attacks in advance. So that's
right.
not a lunatic fringe. That's a lot of people believing something crazy.
It's a lot of, people, but notice that it's phrased. It's not necessarily a lunatic opinion right there. So there are two different versions of the story. One is what I would call the true truther,
yes,
lunatic fringe, that think that 9/11 was organized by the Bush administration. It wasn't really Arabs flying the planes.
Right.
And this was all about a plot to invade Iraq. Right? That's lunatic fringe. And I think that there's never been a poll suggesting it had substantial public belief. The other belief is that people in the U.S. government knew that something bad was going to happen. You know, you've got the August 6th PPD. You've got various FBI and CIA documents. If I can again plug someone's book, my colleague Amy Ziegert has an utterly terrific book called Spying Blind,
yeah,
where she analyzes in detail the internal organizational flaws in the intelligence community, particularly the FBI and the CIA, that led it to be the case that those organizations had in their files plenty of knowledge to spot the 9/11 plot and failed to do so because everybody's still hipped on need to know rather than need to share.
Yeah, I think you're being too, easy on your team here. As I understand the polls, it's did Bush know in advance about the 9/11 attacks? Not should Bush have known in advance because there was enough intelligence to connect the dots. Not was he negligent, but did he know? And if anybody thinks he knew about it and then let it happen, then they think something crazy.
Right. I agree that that's right. Again, I mean, you could say that somebody who got the briefing from that PBD that Al-Qaeda was going to make a major strike within the U.S. and said to the briefer, okay, you've covered your ass, you can go home now. You know, knew or should have known is the way I would phrase it. I would not regard a single Rasmussen poll as being at all dispositive.
I agree, and the polls about Republicans and the birth certificates are the ones I've seen are from Daily Coast, and they're and, you know, you could throw some salt, with a few grains of salt. But I think it's pretty clear. Yeah, I think what's pretty clear is that in our current state of polarized politics, large numbers of people are willing to believe pretty crazy things about people in the opposition. And there you go. And they're willing to believe things that are totally at odds with the way the world works, way the world really is. If that's, you know, part of what their gang thinks, so Gelman also cites a poll in which some astonishingly high number of Republicans not only believed that there were WMDs in Iraq, and this was several years after the invasion, but believe we found them. Likewise, he cites a poll from 88 in which a large majority of Democrats say that inflation had gotten worse during the Reagan administration. I think what we're dealing with is, you know, is public opinion that often is woefully ill-informed and will latch onto any kind of ideologically convenient allegation, whether it has any basis in reality or not.
I think that's right. I think to be fair to the Republicans, if you disaggregate that Research 2000 poll, by the way, the poll is published by Daily Coast.
Yeah.
But it's done by an actual, you know, real research firm, Research 2000, with a pretty good record.
Yep.
That's not in the same habit that Rasmussen is of framing questions in order to get the answer it wants. But if you disaggregate that poll by region,
yes,
it turns out that outside the South, Republicans aren't actually completely crazy. So I think the Obama birther thing is very racialized.
Seems to be a southern, seems to be a southern thing. I agree with that.
Now the problem is that because of what happened in 2006 and 2008.
But again, there are fewer and fewer Republicans outside the South these days. So
right. Right. And so partly you're getting, you know, the beginnings of a death spiral, where the out party is too extreme, loses voters, and the voters it loses are relatively moderate, so it becomes more extreme.
Yeah.
Now, as a Democrat, I don't much more than that.
Right.
But you know, it would be healthy for the country to have two sane political parties.
Yes.
And what strikes me is the extent to which the grown-ups on the Republican side have simply not stood up. I mean, there's now some the Sarah Palin, you know, Obama's death board thing.
Yep.
Has now drawn some serious criticism. But you've got, you know, not obviously crazy voices on the right like Ann Althouse saying, "Oh, well, that was fair rhetoric."
Right.
What? But this other stuff, you just don't see the leadership of the Republican Party saying, "Wait a second, guys." You know, Boehner has been encouraging it. It's a little disappointing that John McCain has decided to imitate his running mate rather than acting like John McCain used to act.
Yeah.
I'm surprised at Richard Lugar. I mean, you know, I don't agree with him politically, but he's certainly a smart and serious guy and a friend of Obama's. And yet I haven't heard him speaking out saying, "Wait a second, we can't do this." And so they're leaving, you know, Limbaugh and Gingrich and Palin as the voice of the Republican Party.
Yeah, so I first I agree with you that the GOP is just in a serious intellectual crisis, and it is in this kind of death spiral that you mentioned, and that's not a good thing. On the kind of angry mobs at the town halls, I agree with you that of course they're organized and encouraged, but still. That means still getting regular people to get out of their homes and go to these meetings. I agree with you that it's unlikely that these loudest, angriest voices are in any way sort of representative of independent voters. I kind of wonder about the whole concept of town halls and why members of Congress take them so seriously, or apparently take them so seriously, since there's just a tiny fraction of the electorate that shows up at these things.
I think it's actually a very sound principle that elected officials ought to make themselves available to any voter who wants to come.
I agree with
that voter has to say. And I don't see evidence that there's certainly a lot of the pundits on the right would love it to be the case that these congressmen are being scared off by the mobs. I don't see any evidence of that. I haven't seen a single member say, "Well, now that I've been mobbed at a town hall, I'm going to vote against health insurance reform."
Yeah, we'll see. But of course, there was, you know, just a frantic push by the Democrats to get bills passed before the August recess because they didn't want to go face their constituents before bills had been passed. They didn't want to take that heat. So that they feared something because they acted panicked about having to get something done before the recess.
I think there were other legislative challenges.
And so on that score, I think we should distinguish between the kind of the red-faced screamers at these meetings and what really does have Democratic legislators in swing districts nervous. And what I see playing out here with health care reform is pretty much the mirror image of what played out with Social Security reform back in 2005, which is that first, this is a very conservative with a small C country. That it's hard to make sweeping systemic changes in big institutions that seem to work well for most people, whether you're doing it from the right or whether you're doing it from the left. And then it's even harder to get anything done in an environment in which public opinion has been so polarized that large numbers of people will believe crazy things about the other side.
Right.
And I think we saw that with Social Security, and we're seeing it with health care. I would say
what was the crazy belief about Social Security?
Oh, just that, you know, that it was going to be gutting benefits for current seniors. When it wasn't. There was no plan on the table to do anything except completely make sacrosanct benefits for current retirees and retirees over age X, you know, whatever it was, 50, 55. So the idea that there was any threat to current benefits was just, you know, not true. And yet that was the main scare tactic, is that you're going to, you know, steal Social Security checks from grandma.
Mm-hmm.
Now the main scare tactic is you're going to kill grandma.
Right.
But I would say
it certainly is the case that many of the advocates of Social Security privatization had previously been making a fuss about the need to rein in entitlements. And it is the case that if we manage to wreck Social Security for the non-retired boomers and people younger than them, that the coalition that holds the thing together might not be sound. But yes, insofar as people believed that the Bush plan would cut current checks, that was wrong. On the other hand, it was going to cut current revenues into the Social Security system. So if you weren't going to cut current checks, then you were simply increasing the bankruptcy for the future.
Right. There was a transition problem. Of course, there was a serious public debate, and the reformers lost that time. The people who called themselves reformers. The people who are calling themselves reformers this time are facing a similar mirror image problem, I think. And I would argue, because, you know, I'm on the other side of the fence on these entitlement issues than you are, that they've got it coming, because I think there is, what's the right word? Dishonesty is harsh. A lot of obfuscation and no little amounts of misrepresentation going on by the advocates of the current legislation going through. First, misrepresentation about intentions. That is, that the centerpiece for progressive hopes for legislation is a public plan. The whole purpose of the public plan is to gradually move us towards single payer, and yet everyone's now acts horrified at that suggestion. That's a terrible calumny and a libel. But in fact, that's the whole reason the public plan was cooked up. And you can.
I've been privy to lots of these discussions, and certainly there are single payer advocates around, and I'm at least tentatively one of them. But there's an argument for the public plan within the context of a competitive system, and basically this is the flip of the charter school argument. That the reason to have charter schools is to keep the public schools honest, because you've got a different organizational form competing with them. And the argument for the public plan is it keeps the insurance companies honest. You don't have to be on a crusade for single payer to think that it'd be good to have a public competitor.
Yeah, it's one thing to keep a monopoly honest by introducing other public competitive options. It's another thing to to introduce one more player into a market we don't keep, the auto industry honest until recently, at least, by having publicly owned auto companies. It's just that's a completely ad hoc argument that has no place in any industry besides this one.
Well, except, the fact is,
I think everyone acknowledges that the public plan would very quickly purge the market of lots of smaller insurers, and so, in fact, there would be fewer competitors in the market.
The CBO model says.
What's that?
The CBO model predicts an increased number of people in private insurance under the bill. So I don't know why it is that you think the smaller insurers would be at risk. Not there that many of them anymore anyway. But the difference between
I guess watching, Jacob Hacker explain his reason for supporting the plan and I think he, played a pretty instrumental role in shaping general progressive attitudes towards healthcare legislation this go round. And he's I'll link to a very nice blog post by my colleague Will Wilkinson, where he's got a clip of Jacob talking about how is this a Trojan horse? Is the public plan a Trojan horse for getting us to single payer? No, it's not a Trojan horse at all. It's right there. That's the whole point of it. So for people to act like it's crazy talk to say that the public plan is runs the risk of being or is potentially a means to get us towards single payer, then I think they're being disingenuous. And then furthermore, I think there's a lot of lack of candor about the effects of this legislation, in particular the idea that we're going to expand the system a lot. We're going to bring in, lots of, if not all, of the 47 million uninsured. Everybody who's happy with the status quo gets to keep exactly what they've got, and we're going to cut costs. I don't see how you can have those three things happen in the universe in which I live. That is, if you're going to, do more for some people, and you've got a budget constraint, it seems like you're going to have to do less for other people, and it seems to me...
Make things more efficient.
What's that?
Or make things more efficient. That's always an option.
Yes, but the way to make things more efficient is to stop providing cost ineffective care, which means that and we're providing lots of cost ineffective care right now under Medicare, and I think and yet the people who receive that cost ineffective care want it and they like it and they realize that if we expand this system, expand government responsibility away from just the over 65 set to a large chunk of the rest of the population, in a time of a big fiscal squeeze, that the odds are that their sweet deal may be coming to an end, and they're right to suspect that. Now, putting it in terms of death panels is just crazy talk, but in there somewhere is the germ of a correct intuition that the ox that's going to get gored in healthcare reform are the people who are sucking up lots of cost-ineffective healthcare these days, and that's senior citizens.
Right. Now, that's not unreasonable. I mean, I would call it an instance where liberals
and so pretending that all this is that this can all be paid for through quote efficiency, like there's just waste, people making too many copies or something. It's not that. It's people delivering too much health care. And so we're going to have to, cut back on that. Otherwise, ration care. Ration in a possibly efficient and defensible way, but do so, right? And that freaks people out because they like what they got.
All right, so several points, right? First, I would call this another instance where liberals made the mistake of listening to conservatives and libertarians and trying to address some of their concerns, right? The whole Medicare has a $72 trillion current value deficit, and we're going to bankrupt the country unless we do something about entitlements, right? That's been a conservative mantra for 15 years now.
And do you disagree with it?
I don't fully disagree with it. There's certainly some need. I mean, the fraction of GDP devoted to healthcare can't go up forever.
Right.
I'm not convinced, I mean, I'm actually quite agnostic on the question, what the right fraction is. It seems to me as we get richer, one thing that people are going to want to buy more of is healthcare. The reason I'm convinced that there's massive inefficiency in the system is that we spend twice as much of our GDP per capita as anybody else in the world. Right? I mean, it can't be the case that it's twice as expensive to do stuff here as it is anywhere else.
Right. I agreed completely. So, but the idea that the association between health insurance and ultimate health outcomes it's not the most important thing out there affecting health outcomes.
Correct.
And so it looks like a good chunk of health spending is just doesn't do anything to really prolong quality-adjusted life years. And yet, for any given person, the idea, if they're told no, that there's some procedure that might help grandma eke out another 6 months of life, and they're told no because it doesn't pass budgetary muster, then they're going to feel like they got rationed to a premature funeral.
Right.
And particularly, taking stuff away from people that they currently have is tough to do. And right now, senior citizens have a lot of extra inefficient, by our definition, cost ineffective care. And if you propose to take it away from them, you're running into a buzzsaw. And particularly if you pretend you're not.
Well, it's of course not only seniors that are getting unnecessary or useless or worse care.
No, agreed.
It's not only seniors who suffer from the fact that the health care business, right, which is rising toward 20% of GDP,
yep,
is the most primitive part of the American economy in terms of its information systems.
Yep.
I mean, every time I go into a doctor's office, I fill out a set of forms in handwriting.
Yes, I know.
Giving them the same data that I've given the previous 20 doctors. So it's not the case that there aren't major inefficiencies to be squeezed out, and we haven't even gotten to the 20% of the total healthcare expenditure, which is the overheads and profits of health insurance companies. All that marketing and underwriting is, from a social point of view, complete waste. So I think there are savings, but you're right. The people who currently benefit.
A chunk of that administrative overhead is weeding out claims that they don't want to pay for, which the government's going to have to do too. So I'm not. I think you overstate the degree of efficiency gains from wiping out the private health insurance industry.
It's mostly marketing and underwriting. Yes, there's a certain amount of claim stuff. And notice what a weird industry this is, right? It makes its money by not delivering what it contracted for. Exactly General Motors. I'm like everybody else. I'm currently fighting with my health insurer about something. It's something they paid for last time and now say, oh, that wasn't covered. But putting that aside, the Medicare problem, right, is that against the warnings of Republicans and libertarians, conservatives and libertarians, we went to a single-payer, socialist, government-run health insurance program, not a health program, because Medicare doesn't deliver any health services.
Right.
It just pays for them.
Correct.
But we went to a socialized medicine system, as Ronald Reagan called it. And the people who get it absolutely love it. And they're now being summoned out to these meetings being told that this bill threatens them with government-run health care.
No, it's
right? This is madness.
One of my favorite quotes is, the world is a comedy to those who think and a tragedy to those who feel. And there's comic elements to this if you're in the right frame of mind. But the tragic element is that
no good deed goes unpunished.
Right. The tragic element is that eventually we're going to have to control healthcare costs, and if the current way in which the Obama program is being opposed is going to make it much more difficult ultimately to do sensible things about Medicare. There's a long train here of bad karma. Republicans have been demonized for any efforts they've made to deal with spiraling Medicare costs. So it's an ongoing sad problem. But we're not going to solve it today. And we've been talking for almost an hour.
Have we? Time flies when you're having fun.
Indeed. So I don't think we've solved all the problems in the world yet. We'll have to take another crack at it before
too long.
Absolutely. Okay?
Thanks, Frank. Always
nice talking to you, Mark. All right, bye-bye.
Take care.